creamed corn side on oval plates, not square. Mushrooms, more shallots, garlic, and marsala. Use the recipes. The staff didn't always love following the recipes. You make the cream corn a few hundred times and you believe you have it down. But that's when things begin to slip, Adam said. The recipes themselves were not necessarily static. All the ones I saw had scribbled modifications in the margins, many of them improvements provided by staff. Sometimes there would be a wholesale revamp. One new dish they were serving was a split whole lobster in cognac and fish broth reduction, with little neck clams and chorizo. The dish is Adams's take on a famous Julia Child recipe. Before putting a dish on the menu, however, she always has the kitchen staff make a few test runs, and some problems emerged. Her recipe called for splitting a lobster and then sautéing it in olive oil, but the results proved too variable. Too often the lobster meat was either overcooked or undercooked. The sauce was also made to order, but it took too long for the 8 to 10 minute turnaround that customers expect. So she and two of her chefs re-engineered the dish. They decided to make the sauce in advance and parboil the lobster ahead of time as well. On repeated test runs, the lobster came out perfectly. The recipe was rewritten. There was also a checklist for every customer. When an order was placed up front, it was printed out on a slip back in the kitchen. The ticket specified the dishes ordered, the table number, the seat number, any preferences specified by the customer or noted in a database from previous visits. Food allergies, for instance, or how the steak should be cooked, or whether this was a special occasion like a birthday or a visit from a VIP whom Adams needed to go out and say hello to. The sous chef, who serves as a kind of field officer for operations, read the tickets off as they came in. Fire mushrooms, fire motes, labo on hold, steak very well done, no gluten, on hold. Fire meant cook it now. On hold meant it was a second course. Labo was the lobster. The steak needed to be cooked all the way through and the customer had a gluten allergy. A readback was expected to confirm that the line cooks had heard the order right. Fire mushrooms, fire motes, said one. Labo on hold, said the seafood cook. Steak very well done, no gluten on hold, said the grill chef. As in the construction world, however, not everything could be anticipated and reduced to a recipe. And so Adams, too, had developed a communication checklist to ensure people recognized and dealt with unexpected problems as a team. At 5 o'clock, half an hour before opening, the staff holds what she calls the powwow. Everyone gathers in the kitchen for a quick check to discuss unanticipated issues and concerns, the unpredictable. The night I was there, they reviewed the reservation count, two menu changes, how to fill in for a sick staff member, and a Sweet 16 party with 20 girls who were delayed and going to arrive in the midst of the dinner rush. Everyone was given a chance to speak, and they made plans for what to do. Of course, this still couldn't guarantee everything would go right. There remained plenty of sources of uncertainty and imperfection. A soup might be plated too early and allowed to cool. A quail might have too little sauce. A striped bass might come off the grill too dry. So Adams had one final check in place. Every plate had to be reviewed by either her or the sous chef before it left the kitchen for the dining room. They made sure the food looked the way it should, checked it against the order ticket, gave it a sniff, or, with a clean spoon, maybe even a taste. I counted the dishes as they went by. At least 5% were sent back. This calamari has to be fried more, the sous chef told the fry cook. We want more of a golden brown. Later, I got to try some of the results. I had the fried olives, the grilled clams, the summer succotash, and a local farm green salad. I also had the lobster. The food was incredible. I left at midnight with my stomach full and my brain racing. Even here, in one of our most particularized and craft-driven enterprises, in a way, Adams's cooking is more art than science, checklists were required. Everywhere I looked, the evidence seemed to point to the same conclusion. There seemed no field or profession where checklists might not help. And that might even include my own. Chapter 5. The First Try. In late 2006, a woman with a British accent and a Geneva telephone number called me. She said that she was from the World Health Organization and she wanted to see whether I might help them organize a group of people to solve a small problem. Officials were picking up indications that the volume of surgery was increasing worldwide and that a significant portion of the care was so unsafe as to be dangerous. So they wanted to develop a global program to reduce avoidable deaths and harm from surgery. I believe my response was, how do you do that? We'll have a meeting, she said. I asked her how much money they'd be devoting to the problem. Oh, there's no real money, she said. I said no, I couldn't do it. I was busy. But she knew what she was about. She said something along the lines of, oh, sorry. I thought you were supposed to be some kind of expert on patient safety in surgery. My mistake. I agreed to help organize the meeting. One of the benefits of joining up to work with WHO was gaining access to the health system reports and data from the organization's 193 member countries. In compiling the available numbers in surgery, my research team and I found that the WHO official's impression was correct. The global volume of surgery had exploded. By 2004, surgeons were performing some 230 million major operations annually, one for every 25 human beings on the planet, and the numbers have likely continued to increase since then. The volume of surgery had grown so swiftly that, without anyone's quite realizing, it has come to exceed global totals for childbirth, only with a death rate 10 to 100 times higher. Although most of the times a given procedure goes just fine, often it doesn't. Estimates of complication rates for hospital surgery range from 3 to 17%. While incidents have gotten smaller and recoveries have gotten quicker, the risks remain serious. Worldwide, at least 7 million people a year are left disabled and at least 1 million dead, a level of harm that approaches that of malaria, tuberculosis, and other traditional public health concerns. Peering at the numbers, I understood why WHO, an organization devoted to solving large-scale public health problems, should suddenly have taken an interest in something as seemingly specific and high-tech as surgical care. Improvement in global economic conditions in recent decades had produced greater longevity and therefore a greater need for essential surgical services. For people with cancers, broken bones, and other traumatic injuries, complications during child delivery, major birth defects, disabling kidney stones and gallstones and hernias. Although there remain some 2 billion people, especially in rural areas, without access to a surgeon, health systems in all countries were now massively increasing the number of surgical procedures performed. As a result, the safety and quality of that care had become a major issue everywhere. But what could be done about it? Remedying surgery as a public health matter is not like remedying, say, polio. I'd traveled with WHO physicians overseeing the campaign to eradicate polio globally and seen how hard just providing vaccines to a population could be. Surgery was drastically more complex. Finding ways to reduce its harm in a single hospital seemed difficult enough. Finding a way that could reach every operating room in the world seemed absurd. With more than 2,500 different surgical procedures, ranging from brain biopsies to toe amputations, pacemaker insertions to spleen extractions, appendectomies to kidney transplants, you don't even know where to start. Perhaps, I thought, I could work with WHO to focus on reducing the harm of just one procedure, much like with central lines. But how much of a dent would that make in a problem of this scale? In January 2007, at WHO headquarters in Geneva, we convened a two-day meeting of surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, safety experts, even patients from around the world to puzzle through what could be done. We had clinicians from top facilities in Europe, Canada, and the United States. We had the chief surgeon for the International Committee of the Red Cross, who had sent teams to treat sick and wounded refugees everywhere from Mogadishu to Indonesia. We had a father from Zambia whose daughter inadvertently suffocated from lack of oxygen during treatment. As the group told stories of their findings and experiences with surgery around the world, I became only more skeptical. How could we possibly attempt to address so many different issues in so many different places? A medical officer in his 40s from western Ghana, where cocoa growing and gold mining had brought a measure of prosperity, told of the conditions in his district hospital. No surgeon was willing to stay, he said. Ghana was suffering from a brain drain, losing many of its highest skilled citizens to better opportunities abroad. He told us his entire hospital had just 3 medical officers, general physicians with no surgical training. Nevertheless, when a patient arrives critically ill and bleeding after 2 days in labor, or sick and feverish from appendicitis, or with a collapsed lung after a motorbike crash, the untutored doctors do what they have to do. They operate. You must understand, he said, I manage everything. I am the pediatrician, obstetrician, surgeon, everything. He had textbooks and a manual of basic surgical techniques. He had an untrained assistant who had learned how to give basic anesthesia. His hospital's equipment was rudimentary. The standards were poor. Things sometimes went wrong. But he was convinced doing something was better than doing nothing at all. A Russian bioengineer spoke. He'd spent much of his career overseeing the supply and service of medical equipment to hospitals in different parts of the world, and he described dangerous problems in both high- and low-income settings. Inadequately maintained surgical devices that have set fire to patients or electrocuted them. New technologies used incorrectly because teams had not received proper training. Critical life-saving equipment that was locked away in a cabinet or missing when people needed it. The chief of surgery for the largest hospital in Mongolia described shortages of pain control medications, and others from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East recounted the same. A New Zealand researcher spoke of terrifying death rates in poor countries from unsafe anesthesia, noting that although some places in Africa had fewer than 1 in 5,000 patients die from general anesthesia, others had rates more than 10 times worse, with one study in Togo showing 1 in 150 died. An anesthesiologist from India chimed in, tracing problems with anesthesia to the low respect most surgeons accord anesthetists. In her country, she said, they shout anesthetists down and disregard the safety issues that her colleagues raise. Medical students see this and decide not to go into anesthesiology. As a result, the most risky part of surgery, anesthesia, is done by untrained people far more often than the surgery itself. A nurse from Ireland joined the clamor. Nurses work under even worse conditions, she said. They are often ignored as members of the team, condescended to, or fired for raising concerns. She'd seen it in her home country, and from her colleagues abroad she knew it to be the experience of nurses internationally. On the one hand, everyone firmly agreed. Surgery is enormously valuable to people's lives everywhere and should be made more broadly available. Even under the grimmest conditions, it is frequently life-saving. And in much of the world, the serious complication rates seem acceptably low, in the 5 to 10% range for hospital operations. On the other hand, the idea that such rates are acceptable was hard to swallow. Each percentage point, after all, represented millions left disabled or dead. Studies in the United States alone had found that at least half of surgical complications were preventable. But the causes and contributors were of every possible variety. We needed to do something. What, though, wasn't clear. Some suggested more training programs. The idea withered almost upon utterance. If these failures were problems in every country, indeed very likely in every hospital, no training program could be deployed widely enough to make a difference. There was neither the money nor the capacity. We discussed incentive approaches, such as the pay-for-performance schemes recently initiated on a trial basis in the United States. In these programs, Clinicians receive financial rewards for being more consistent about giving, say, heart attack patients the proper care, or incur penalties for not doing so. The strategy has shown results, but the gains have been modest. The country's largest pay-for-performance trial, for example, registered just 2-4% improvement. Furthermore, the measurements required for incentive payments are not easy to obtain. They rely on clinicians' self-reported results, which are not always accurate. The results are also strongly affected by how sick patients are to begin with. One might be tempted, for example, to pay surgeons with higher complication rates less, but some might simply have sicker patients. The incentive programs have thus far been expensive, incremental, and of limited benefit. Taking them global was unimaginable. The most straightforward thing for the group to do would have been to formulate and publish under the WHO name a set of official standards for safe surgical care. It is the approach expert panels commonly take. Such guidelines could cover everything from measures to prevent infection in surgery to expectations for training and cooperation in operating rooms. This would be our Geneva Convention on Safe Surgery, our Helsinki Accord to stop operating room mayhem. But one had only to take a walk through the dim concrete basement hallways of the otherwise soaring WHO headquarters to start doubting that plan. Down in the basement, while taking a shortcut between buildings, I saw pallet after pallet of 200-page guideline books from other groups that had been summoned to make their expert pronouncements. There were guidelines stacked waist high on malaria prevention, HIV/AIDS treatment, and influenza management, all shrink-wrapped against the gathering dust. The standards had been carefully written and were, I am sure, wise and well-considered. Some undoubtedly raised the bar of possibility for achievable global standards. But in most cases, they had at best trickled out into the world. At the bedsides of patients in Bangkok and Brazzaville, Boston and Brisbane, little had changed. I asked a WHO official whether the organization had a guidebook on how to carry out successful global public health programs. She regarded me with a look that a parent might give a toddler searching the dog's mouth for the thing that makes the barking noise. It's a cute idea, but idiotic. I searched anyway. I asked people around WHO for examples of public health interventions we could learn from. They came up with instances like the smallpox vaccination campaign that eradicated the scourge from the world in 1979, and the work of Dr. John Snow, famously tracing a deadly 1854 London cholera outbreak to water in a public well. When the disease struck a London neighborhood that summer, 200 people died in the first 3 days. 3/4 of the area's residents fled in panic. Nonetheless, by the next week, some 500 more died. The dominant belief was that diseases like cholera were caused by miasmas, putrefied air. But Snow, skeptical of the bad air theory, made a map of where the deceased had lived and found them clustered around a single water source, a well in Soho's Broad Street. He interviewed the bereaved families about their habits. He made a careful statistical analysis of possible factors, and he concluded that contaminated water had caused the outbreak. It was later discovered that the well had been dug next to a leaking cesspit. Snow persuaded the local council to remove the water well's pump handle. This disabled the well, ended the spread of the disease, and also established the essential methods of outbreak investigation that infectious disease specialists follow to this day. All the examples I noticed had a few attributes in common. They involved simple interventions, a vaccine, the removal of a pump handle. The effects were carefully measured, and the interventions proved to have widely transmissible benefits. What business types would term a large ROI, return on investment, or what Archimedes would have called merely leverage. Thinking of these essential requirements, simple, measurable, transmissible, I recall one of my favorite public health studies. It was a joint public health program conducted by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and HOPE, a charitable organization in Pakistan, to address the perilous rates of premature death among children in the slums of Karachi. The squatter settlements surrounding the megacity contained more than 4 million people living under some of the most crowded and squalid conditions in the world. Sewage ran in the streets. Chronic poverty and food shortages left 30 to 40% of the children malnourished. Virtually all drinking water sources were contaminated. 1 child in 10 died before age 5, usually from diarrhea and acute respiratory infections. The roots of these problems were deep and multifactorial. Besides inadequate water and sewage systems, illiteracy played a part, hampering the spread of basic health knowledge. Corruption, political instability, and bureaucracy discouraged investment in local industry that might provide jobs and money for families to improve their conditions. Low global agriculture prices made rural farming life impossible, causing hundreds of thousands to flock to the cities in search of work, which only increased the crowding. Under these circumstances, it seemed unlikely that any meaningful improvement in the health of children could be made without a top-to-bottom reinvention of government and society. But a young public health worker had an idea. Stephen Luby had grown up in Omaha, Nebraska, where his father chaired the obstetrics and gynecology faculty at Creighton University. He attended medical school at the University of Texas Southwestern, but for some reason he was always drawn to public health work. He took a CDC job investigating infectious outbreaks in South Carolina, but when a position came open in the CDC's Pakistan office, he jumped to take it. He arrived in Karachi with his schoolteacher wife and began publishing his first investigations of conditions there in the late 90s. I had spoken to him once about how he thought through the difficulties. If we had the kinds of water and sewage systems we've got in Omaha, we could solve these problems, he said. But you have to wait decades for major infrastructure projects. So instead, he said, he looked for low-tech solutions. In this case, the solution he came up with was so humble it seemed laughable to his colleagues. It was soap. Luby learned that Procter & Gamble, the consumer product conglomerate, was eager to prove the value of its new antibacterial Safeguard soap. So despite his colleagues' skepticism, he persuaded the company to provide a grant for a proper study and to supply cases of Safeguard both with and without triclocarban, an antibacterial agent. Once a week, field workers from HOPE fanned out through 25 randomly chosen neighborhoods in the Karachi slums, distributing the soap, some with the antibacterial agent and some without. They encouraged people to use it in 6 situations, to wash their bodies once daily and to wash their hands every time they defecated, wiped an infant, or were about to eat, prepare food, or feed it to others. The field workers then collected information on illness rates among children in the test neighborhoods, as well as in 11 control neighborhoods where no soap was distributed. Luby and his team reported their results in a landmark paper published in The Lancet in 2005. Families in the test neighborhoods received an average of 3.3 bars of soap per week for 1 year. During this period, the incidence of diarrhea among children in these neighborhoods fell 52% compared to that in the control group, no matter which soap was used. The incidence of pneumonia fell 48%, and the incidence of impetigo, a bacterial skin infection, fell 35%. These were stunning results. And they were achieved despite the illiteracy, the poverty, the crowding, and even the fact that however much soap they used, people were still drinking and washing with contaminated water. Ironically, Luby said, Procter & Gamble considered the study something of a disappointment. His research team had found no added benefit from having the antibacterial agent in the soap. Plain soap proved just as effective. Against seemingly insuperable odds, it was more than good enough. Plain soap was leverage. The secret, he pointed out to me, was that the soap was more than soap. It was a behavior change delivery vehicle. The researchers hadn't just handed out Safeguard after all. They also gave out instructions, on leaflets and in person, explaining the 6 situations in which people should use it. This was essential to the difference they made. When one looks closely at the details of the Karachi study, one finds a striking statistic about the households in both the test and the control neighborhoods. At the start of the study, the average number of bars of soap households used was not 0, it was 2 bars per week. In other words, they already had soap. So what did the study really change? Well, 2 things, Luby told me. First, we remove the economic restraint on purchasing soap. People say soap is cheap, and most households have soap. But we wanted people to wash a lot, and people are quite poor. So we remove that as a barrier. Second, and just as important, the project managed to make soap use more systematic. Luby and his team had studied washing behavior in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other locations around South Asia, and they found that almost everyone washes their hands after defecation. There are strong ideas about purity in South Asia, he said. Even when the place to wash is far away, people go and clean their hands over 80% of the time, a rate that would put most denizens of airport bathrooms to shame. But the washing was not very effective, the researchers found. Often people did it too quickly, or they cleaned just the involved hand, or they used ash or mud rather than soap and water. The soap experiment changed that. The field workers gave specific instructions on hand washing technique, on the need to wet both hands completely, to lather well, to rinse all the soap off, even if, out of necessity, as the published report noted, hands were typically dried on participants' clothing. The instructions also got people used to washing at moments when they weren't used to doing so. Before preparing food or feeding a child is not a time when people think about washing, Luby explained. The soap itself was also a factor. It was really nice soap, he pointed out. It smelled good and lathered better than the usual soap people bought. People liked washing with it. Global multinational corporations are really focused on having a good consumer experience, which sometimes public health people are not. Lastly, people liked receiving the soap. The public health field workers were bringing them a gift rather than wagging a finger. And with the gift came a few basic ideas that would improve their lives and massively reduce disease. Thinking back on the experiment, I was fascinated to realize that it was as much a checklist study as a soap study. So I wondered, could a checklist be our soap for surgical care? Simple, cheap, effective, and transmissible? I still had a hard time grasping how to make a checklist that could be both simple and effective for the manifold problems posed by surgery on a global scale. I was uncertain that it was even possible. But several of my colleagues were more sanguine when the idea was raised at the Geneva meeting. One brought up the experience of Columbus Children's Hospital, which had developed a checklist to reduce surgical infections. Infection is one of the most common complications of surgery in children, and the most effective way to prevent it, aside from using proper antiseptic technique, is to make sure you give an appropriate antibiotic during the 60-minute window before the incision is made. The timing is key. Once the incision is made, it is too late for the antibiotic. Give it more than 60 minutes before the procedure, and the antibiotic is worn off. But give it on time, and studies show this single step reduces the infection risk by up to half. Even if the antibiotic is squeezed into the bloodstream only 30 seconds before the incision is made, researchers have found, the circulation time is fast enough for the drug to reach the tissue before the knife breaches the skin. Yet the step is commonly missed. In 2005, Columbus Children's Hospital examined its records and found that more than 1/3 of its appendectomy patients failed to get the right antibiotic at the right time. Some got it too soon. Some got it too late. Some did not receive an antibiotic at all. It seems dumb. How hard could this be? Even people in medicine assume we get this kind of simple task right 100% of the time. But in fact, we don't. With all the flurry of things that go on when a patient is wheeled into an operating room, this is exactly the sort of step that can be neglected. The anesthesiologists are the ones who have to provide the antibiotic, but they are concentrating on getting the patient safely and calmly to sleep, and this is no small matter when that patient is a scared 8-year-old lying naked on a cold table in a room full of strangers getting ready to cut into her. Add in an equipment malfunction. Is that red light supposed to be blinking like that? Or the patient's asthma acting up? Or a page for the surgeon to call the emergency room? And you begin to see how something as mundane as an antibiotic can slip past. The hospital's director of surgical administration, who happened to be not only a pediatric cardiac surgeon but also a pilot, decided to take the aviation approach. He designed a pre-incision cleared for takeoff checklist that he put on a whiteboard in each of the operating rooms. It was really simple. There was a checkbox for the nurse to verbally confirm with the team that they had the correct patient and the correct side of the body planned for surgery, something teams are supposed to verify in any case. And there was a further checkbox to confirm that the antibiotics were given, or else judged unnecessary, which they can be for some operations. There wasn't much more to it, but getting teams to stop and use the checklist to make it their habit was clearly tricky. A couple of check boxes weren't going to do much all by themselves. So the surgical director gave some lectures to the nurses, anesthesiologists, and surgeons explaining what this checklist was all about. He also did something curious. He designed a little metal tent stenciled with the phrase, "cleared for takeoff," and arranged for it to be placed in the surgical instrument kits. The metal tent was 6 inches long, just long enough to cover a scalpel, and the nurses were asked to set it over the scalpel when laying out the instruments before a case. This served as a reminder to run the checklist before making the incision. Just as important, it also made clear that the surgeon could not start the operation until the nurse gave the okay and removed the tent, a subtle cultural shift. Even a modest checklist had the effect of distributing power. The surgical director measured the effect on care. After 3 months, 89% of appendicitis patients got the right antibiotic at the right time. After 10 months, 100% did. The checklist had become habitual, and it had also become clear that team members could hold up an operation until the necessary steps were completed. I was intrigued, but I remained doubtful. Yes, using a checklist, this one hospital got one aspect of care to go consistently right for surgical patients. I was even willing to believe their surgical infection rates had fallen significantly as a result. But to take a serious bite out of overall complication rates, I argued, we needed an approach that would help across the much wider range of ways in which surgery can go wrong. Then Richard Resnick, the chairman of surgery at the University of Toronto, spoke up. He explained that his hospital had completed a feasibility trial using a much broader 21-item surgical checklist. They had tried to design it, he said, to catch a whole span of potential errors in surgical care. Their checklist had staff verbally confirm with one another that antibiotics had been given, that blood was available if required, that critical scans and test results needed for the operation were on hand, that any special instruments required were ready, and so on. The checklist also included what they called a team briefing. The team members were supposed to stop and take a moment simply to talk with one another before proceeding, about how long the surgeon expected the operation to take, how much blood loss everyone should be prepared for, whether the patient had any risks or concerns the team should know about. Resnick had never heard about the demise of master builders, but he had gravitated intuitively toward the skyscraper solution, a mix of task and communication checks to manage the problem of proliferating complexity, and so had others, it turned out. A Johns Hopkins pancreatic surgeon named Martin McCary showed us an 18-item checklist that he tested with 11 surgeons for 5 months at his hospital. Likewise, a group of Southern California hospitals within the Kaiser healthcare system had studied a 30-item surgery pre-flight checklist that actually predated the Toronto and Hopkins innovations. All of them follow the same basic design. Surgery has, essentially, four big killers wherever it is done in the world: infection, bleeding, unsafe anesthesia, and what can only be called the unexpected. For the first three, science and experience have given us some straightforward and valuable preventive measures we think we consistently follow, but don't. These misses are simple failures, perfect for a classic checklist. And as a result, all the researchers' checklists included precisely specified steps to catch them. But the fourth killer, the unexpected, is an entirely different kind of failure, one that stems from the fundamentally complex risks entailed by opening up a person's body and trying to tinker with it. Independently, each of the researchers seemed to have realized that no one checklist could anticipate all the pitfalls a team must guard against. So they had determined that the most promising thing to do was just to have people stop and talk through the case together, to be ready as a team to identify and address each patient's unique, potentially critical dangers. Perhaps all this seems kind of obvious, but it represents a significant departure from the way operations are usually conducted. Traditionally, surgery has been regarded as an individual performance, the surgeon as virtuoso, like a concert pianist. There's a reason that much of the world uses the phrase operating theater. The OR is the surgeon's stage. The surgeon strides under the lights and expects to start, everyone in their places, the patient laid out asleep and ready to go. We surgeons want to believe that we've evolved along with the complexity of surgery, that we work more as teams now. But however embarrassing it may be for us to admit, researchers have observed that team members are commonly not all aware of a given patient's risks, or the problems they need to be ready for, or why the surgeon is doing the operation. In one survey of 300 staff members as they exited the operating room following a case, 1 out of 8 reported that they were not even sure about where the incision would be until the operation started. Brian Sexton, a pioneering Johns Hopkins psychologist, has conducted a number of studies that provide a stark measure of how far we are from really performing as teams in surgery. In one, he surveyed more than 1,000 operating room staff members from hospitals in 5 countries, the United States, Germany, Israel, Italy, and Switzerland, and found that although 64% of the surgeons rated their operations as having high levels of teamwork, just 39% of anesthesiologists, 28% of nurses, and 10% of anesthesia residents did. Not coincidentally, Sexton also found that 1 in 4 surgeons believe that junior team members should not question the decisions of a senior practitioner. The most common obstacle to effective teams, it turns out, is not the occasional fire-breathing, scalpel-flinging, terror-inducing surgeon, though some do exist. One favorite example: several years ago, when I was in training, a senior surgeon grew incensed with one of my fellow residents for questioning the operative plan and commanded him to leave the table and stand in the corner until he was sorry. When he refused, the surgeon threw him out of the room and tried to get him suspended for insubordination. No, the more familiar and widely dangerous issue is a kind of silent disengagement, the consequence of specialized technicians sticking narrowly to their domains. "That's not my problem" is possibly the worst thing people can think, whether they are starting an operation, taxiing an airplane full of passengers down a runway, or building a 1,000-foot-tall skyscraper. But in medicine, we see it all the time. I've seen it in my own operating room. Teamwork may just be hard in certain lines of work. Under conditions of extreme complexity, we inevitably rely on a division of tasks and expertise. In the operating room, for example, there is the surgeon, the surgical assistant, the scrub nurse, the circulating nurse, the anesthesiologist, and so on. They can each be technical masters at what they do. That's what we train them to be, and that alone can take years. But the evidence suggests we need them to see their job not just as performing their isolated set of tasks well, but also as helping the group get the best possible results. This requires finding a way to ensure that the group lets nothing fall between the cracks, and also adapts as a team to whatever problems might arise. I had assumed that achieving this kind of teamwork was mostly a matter of luck. I'd certainly experienced it at times, difficult operations in which everyone was nonetheless firing on all cylinders, acting as one. I remember an 80-year-old patient who required an emergency operation. He had undergone heart surgery the week before and had been recovering nicely. But during the night, he developed a sudden, sharp, unrelenting pain in his abdomen, and over the course of the morning it had mounted steadily in severity. I was asked to see him from general surgery. I found him lying in bed, prostrate with pain. His heart rate was over 100 and irregular. His blood pressure was dropping, and wherever I touched his abdomen, the sensation made him almost leap off the bed in agony. He knew this was trouble. His mind was completely sharp, but he didn't seem scared. "What do we need to do?" he asked between gritted teeth. I explained that I believed his body had thrown a clot into his intestine's arterial supply. It was as if he'd had a stroke, only this one had cut off blood flow to his bowel, not his brain. Without blood flow, his bowel would turn gangrenous and rupture. This was not survivable without surgery. But, I also had to tell him, it was often not survivable even with surgery. Perhaps half of the patients in his circumstance made it through. If he was one of them, there would be many complications to worry about. He might need a ventilator or a feeding tube. He'd already been through one major operation. He was weak and not young. I asked him if he wanted to go ahead. "Yes," he said, but he wanted me to speak with his wife and son first. I reached them by phone. They too said to proceed. I called the operating room control desk and explained the situation. I needed an OR and a team right away. I'd take whatever and whoever were available. We got him to the OR within the hour, and as people assembled and set to work, there was the sense of a genuine team taking form. Jay, the circulating nurse, introduced himself to the patient and briefly explained what everyone was doing. Steve, the scrub nurse, was already gowned and gloved, standing by with the sterile instruments at the ready. Z, the senior anesthesiologist, and Thor, his resident, were conferring, making sure they had their plans straight as they set out their drugs and equipment. Joaquim, the surgery resident, stood by with a Foley catheter, ready to slip it into the patient's bladder as soon as he was asleep. The clock was ticking. The longer we took, the more bowel would die. The more bowel that died, the sicker the man would become and the lower his chance of survival. Everyone understood this, which by itself was a lot. People don't always get it, really feel the urgency of the patient's condition, but these people did. They were swift, methodical, and in sync. The case was far from easy, but for whatever reason, it seemed like nothing could thwart us. The patient was a big man with a short neck and not much lung reserve, making it potentially difficult to place a breathing tube when Z sent him off to sleep. But Z had warned us of the possibility of trouble, and everyone was ready with a backup plan and the instruments he and Thor might need. When Joaquim and I opened up the patient, we found that the right colon was black with gangrene. It had died, but it had not ruptured, and the remaining 3/4 of the colon and all the small bowel seemed to be okay. This was actually good news. The problem was limited. As we began removing the right colon, however, it became evident that the rest of the colon was not, in fact, in good shape. Where it should have been healthy pink, we found scattered dime and quarter-sized patches of purple. The blood clots that had blocked off the main artery to the right colon had also showered into the arterial branches of the left side. We would have to remove the patient's entire colon, all 4 feet of it, and give him an ostomy, a bag for his excreted wastes. Steve, thinking ahead, asked Jay to grab a retractor we'd need. Joaquim nudged me to make the abdominal incision bigger, and he stayed with me at every step, clamping, cutting, and tying as we proceeded inch by inch through the blood vessels tethering the patient's colon. The patient began oozing blood from every raw surface. Toxins from the gangrene were causing him to lose his ability to clot. But Z and Thor kept up with the fluid requirements, and the patient's blood pressure was actually better halfway through than it had been at the beginning. When I mentioned that I thought the patient would need an ICU, Z told me he'd already arranged it and briefed the intensivist. Because we'd worked as a single unit, not as separate technicians, the man survived. We were done with the operation in little more than 2 hours. His vital signs were stable, and he would leave the hospital just a few days later. The family gave me the credit, and I wish I could have taken it. But the operation had been symphonic, a thing of orchestral beauty. Perhaps I could claim that the teamwork itself had been my doing, but its origins were mysterious to me. I'd have said it was just the good fortune of the circumstances, the accidental result of the individuals who happened to be available for the case and their particular chemistry on that particular afternoon. Although I operated with Z frequently, I hadn't worked with Jay or Steve in months, Joaquim in even longer. I'd worked with Thor just once. As a group of six, we'd never before done an operation together. Such a situation is not uncommon in hospitals of any significant size. My hospital has 42 operating rooms, staffed by more than 1,000 personnel. We have new nurses, technicians, residents, and physician staff almost constantly. We're virtually always adding strangers to our teams. As a consequence, the level of teamwork, an unspoken but critical component of success in surgery, is unpredictable. Yet somehow, from the moment we six were all dropped together into this particular case, things clicked. It had been almost criminally enjoyable. This seemed like luck, as I say, but suppose it wasn't. That's what the checklists from Toronto and Hopkins and Kaiser raised as a possibility. Their insistence that people talk to one another about each case, at least just for a minute before starting, was basically a strategy to foster teamwork, a kind of team huddle, as it were. So was another step that these checklists employed, one that was quite unusual in my experience. Surgical staff members were expected to stop and make sure that everyone knew one another's names. The Johns Hopkins checklist spelled this out most explicitly. Before starting an operation with a new team, there was a check to ensure everyone introduced themselves by name and role. I'm Atul Gawande, the attending surgeon. I'm Jay Powers, the circulating nurse. I'm Z Zhang, the anesthesiologist, that sort of thing. It felt kind of hokey to me, and I wondered how much difference this step could really make. But it turned out to have been carefully devised. There have been psychology studies in various fields backing up what should have been self-evident. People who don't know one another's names don't work together nearly as well as those who do. And Brian Sexton, the Johns Hopkins psychologist, had done studies showing the same in operating rooms. In one, he and his research team buttonholed surgical staff members outside their operating rooms and asked them two questions. How would they rate the level of communications during the operation they had just finished, and what were the names of the other staff members on the team? The researchers learned that about half the time, the staff did not know one another's names. When they did, however, the communications ratings jumped significantly. The investigators at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere had also observed that when nurses were given a chance to say their names and mention concerns at the beginning of a case, they were more likely to note problems and offer solutions. The researchers called it an activation phenomenon. Giving people a chance to say something at the start seemed to activate their sense of participation and responsibility and their willingness to speak up. These were limited studies and hardly definitive, but the initial results were enticing. Nothing had ever been shown to improve the ability of surgeons to broadly reduce harm to patients aside from experience and specialized training. Yet here, in three separate cities, teams had tried out these unusual checklists, and each had found a positive effect. At Johns Hopkins, researchers specifically measured their checklists' effect on teamwork. 11 surgeons had agreed to try it in their cases, 7 general surgeons, 2 plastic surgeons, and 2 neurosurgeons. After 3 months, the number of team members in their operations reporting that they functioned as a well-coordinated team leapt from 68% to 92%. At the Kaiser Hospitals in Southern California, researchers had tested their checklist for 6 months in 3,500 operations. During that time, they found that their staff's average rating of the teamwork climate improved from good to outstanding. Employee satisfaction rose 19%. The rate of OR nurse turnover, the proportion leaving their jobs each year, dropped from 23% to 7%, and the checklist appeared to have caught numerous near errors. In one instance, the preoperative briefing led the team to recognize that a vial of potassium chloride had been switched with an antibiotic vial, a potentially lethal mix-up. In another, the checklist led the staff to catch a paperwork error that had them planning for a thoracotomy, an open-chest procedure with a huge front-to-back wound, when what the patient had come in for was actually a thoracoscopy, a videoscope procedure done with a quarter-inch incision. At Toronto, the researchers physically observed operations for specific evidence of impact. They watched their checklist in use in only 18 operations, but in 10 of those 18, they found that it had revealed significant problems or ambiguities. In more than one case, a failure to give antibiotics, for example. In another, uncertainty about whether blood was available. And in several, the kinds of unique and individual patient problems that I would not have expected a checklist to help catch. They reported one case, for example, involving an abdominal operation under a spinal anesthetic. In such procedures, we need the patient to report if he or she begins to feel even a slight twinge of pain, indicating the anesthetic might be wearing off and require supplementation. But this particular patient had a severe neurological condition that had left him unable to communicate verbally. Instead, he communicated through hand signals. Normally, we restrain the arms and hands of patients to keep them from inadvertently reaching around the sterile drapes and touching the surgeons or the operative field. In this instance, however, the regular routine would have caused a serious problem, but this was not